And hello, Stone's House listeners. This is Andy Bombeck, which means, once again, it's time for the Children's Story Hour. And as always, I'm glad you could join me today for a good variety of children's stories. Like always, the first half hour, I'll be reading picture books. And then the second half hour, I'm going to continue with the novel that I just started last week, a very short novel that won the Caldecott Award in 1958, titled The Family Under the Bridge. But first, let's begin today's program with the picture book titles. I'm going to start off with a book titled A Family for Faru. And then it's Cookie, Treasure Box, Nothing in Common, Duck and Goose. And if we have time, we'll finish up the first half hour with Ivanhoe Swift Left Home at 6. So it should be a lot of fun. Let's get started with our first picture book today, titled A Family for Faru. And this book is dedicated for all the rhinos like Faru. I hope someday soon you live your lives in peace and quiet, wild and free. You deserve that and so much more. The sun creeps above the treetops and warms the air with the smell of lemongrass. Titaya inhales the tangy scent. Mmm. Beside him, Faru rubs against a tree. Titania scratches the orphan rhino's back. I know it has been days since we came upon you all alone. Mama's been trying to find you a new family. Titania looks out across the stream. Maybe it's time I tried instead. Titania, Mama calls, bring me some water berries, please. Titania pulls off handfuls of berries, offers some to Faru, and puts the rest in his basket for his mother. He dashes back to his house. Too fast. The basket of berries slips from Titania's arms. Stop, Faru! Titania shouts. Da-boom, da-boom, da-boom. Faru doesn't stop. He gallops forward, stomping, crushing, squishing, staining his feet pink. That was our lunch, Titania scolds. The little rhino lowers his head. Mama smiles. It's all right. You can pick more berries later. Faru runs in circles, kicking up dust. Come on, Titania says to Faru. Let's go find some rhinos. And they set off. They pass giraffes gliding through the long grass, but no rhinos. They dash by a troop of vervet monkeys, snacking high in the trees, but no rhinos. They weave around a family of guinea fowl, scourging for seeds. Still no rhinos. They climb a hill. The entire savanna spreads out below in greens, golds, and browns. Faru raises his head and squeals. No rhinos answer his call. Don't worry, we'll find them. Titania rubs Faru's horn. But the air is so hot, let's rest for a bit. They cool off in a pond of mud. Gather more water berries for lunch and fall asleep under the shade of a jackalberry tree. The sound of cracking twigs wakes them. They peek around the tree, hunters. Faru hides his face in the tree's roots. We are brothers now, Titania says. I will keep you safe. But how? Titania thumps his frustration into the ground. Leftover berries ooze between his toes, staining them pink. A wild idea forms in his head. Titania straightens just as the two men appear. One steps forward. Who did this to the rhino's horn? He demands. Titania hides his hands behind his back. Faru nuzzles Titania's legs. The man scowls. We can't take one with a horn like that. And they stomp off. Titania and Faru wait and wait and wait. It's safe, Titania says, stroking Faru. They're far away now. Faru raises his head and trills his relief. This time, his joyous cries echo back. Titania and Faru gallop toward the sounds. At last, they come upon a crash of rhinos drinking from a watering hole. Nearby, a ranger waves. I found a baby rhino for you to look after. Titania calls, waving back. He smiles down at Faru. Here is your new family. The ranger ambles over to Faru and rubs his horn. The other rhinos lift their heads in welcome. Faru runs toward the watering hole. Badoom, badoom, badoom. Then stops. He turns back. Go on, Titania urges. I'll see you again soon. Titania smiles. He gazes at his hands and heads back home, stopping for some water berries along the way. Okay, this next story is about a dog named Cookie, and the book is titled Cookie. I don't remember much before Girl. I was in a very shaky box for a long time, a time even longer than my tongue. When the very shaky box stopped shaking, there was a girl. Girl was warm and good to lick, and she had ball. Girl said I was Cookie because cookies make things better. I love you, Cookie, she said. We went to find a boy that first day. Our boy, girl said. The boy was called Stop It, but sometimes girl called him Soosh instead. He called her, You're not the boss of me. Together we found the yummiest smells. I had a lead, so girl didn't get lost. When it was dark, girl tucked me into a cuddle. Then she got in her big cuddle, and we went to sleep. The next day, girl was sad. She didn't want to play. Stop It was there. He played with me, but I wanted to play with girl. So I took her a present. I love you, my cookie, she said. Girl tried to play, but she was too sad. So we cuddled instead. Playing is better than cuddles. But girl is very good at cuddles, especially when she's sad. Girl's sad made mama sad too. I was good at sad. You can lick it off, you know. I love you the most, my cookie, girl said. We went for lots of walks and smelled lots of smelly smells and made lots of friends, but mostly we did lots of chewing. I love you, silly cookie, said girl. Girl still slept in her big cuddle a lot. Maybe it wasn't working, I thought, so I tried to share mine. I love you, little cookie, girl said. I got so big I could take girl on adventures. She taught me good games like how to sit and stop and come. Those games have cheese. I like cheese. Sometimes nothing could make girl smile except me, because I do such good bounces. I love you, gorgeous cookie, said girl. We played, we cuddled, we chewed, we ate. And when girl got sad, I licked her happy again. We rolled and smelled and ran and chewed some more. And there was less sad on girl to lick. But she tasted nice, so I licked her anyway. I love you, my crazy cookie, girl said. I got so big, I could run as fast as stop it. And Dad, when he got stuck. I helped so much girl got happier. And everyone is happier when girl is happier, especially me. Now we leap and we zoom and we chase and we hug. But most of all, I lick my girl. I love you, my cookie, says girl. I love you too, my girl. The treasure box. I am always on the lookout. I look for special things to put in my secret treasure box. Since the last time Grandpa visited, I have found many interesting and amazing things. A very round and very smooth rock, a green parachute guy who lost his parachute, a suit of dried up skin a snake left behind, a tiny bird's nest that has blue yarn in it, a giant feather, and a very, 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 very straight stick. That's why I'm waiting by the window. I know he'll like to see what I found. My collection of treasures is our secret. When Grandpa and Grammy arrive, I have to wait for them to drink their tea and talk forever with Mommy and Daddy. Later, Grandpa and I sneak away. He takes a long time to get up the stairs. I am slow but graceful like a cat, he says. Grandpa always takes out his magnifying glass before I open the latch. I make him hold the snake skin, even though he doesn't want to. He makes the funniest faces. Grandpa taps his watch and says it's time. We go for a walk to see if we can find any treasures. We collect things in his little blue hat. Grandpa finds a rusty spring and a doll's lost arm. I find a dirty marble and a cracked open robin's egg. These are perfect, I say. When Grandpa gets sick and can't visit, I spend time in my room looking at our collection. It reminds me of all his funny faces. I keep asking to go to Grandpa and Grammy's house, and one day we finally do. Grandpa has tubes in his nose, but he can still make funny faces. When nobody is around, I show him two new things I found for the treasure box. He likes them so much, he cries a little bit. The next time I see Grandpa, he's in a hospital. His room has a wide open door, beeping machines, and a sit-up bed. But he's sound asleep anyway. He just needs to rest, honey, Mom says. Before we go, I leave a few treasures. He'll know who brought them. One day, Mommy and Daddy come to my room and tell me that Grandpa died. I don't say anything. I look out the window and pretend I can see him waving at me. I go with Mommy and Daddy to Grandpa's memorial, which is a sad party you have when someone dies. The grown-ups talk and talk and talk and talk. I just can't eat any of the tiny sandwiches. Instead, I stare at all the photos of Grandpa when he had lots of hair and smooth skin. I say goodbye to Grandpa in my heart. When we come home, I pull out my secret treasure box. But I don't undo the latch. I'm too sad, and opening it would make it worse. It's a long time before Grammy comes back to visit. I watch her out the window, and she waves. She is all alone now. I listen as she drinks tea with Mommy and Daddy. Then Grammy comes to my room. Your grandpa gave me some things to give to you, she tells me quietly. She pulls out Grandpa's little blue hat, his magnifying glass, and his watch. He told me you would know what to do with them, she says. I nod. I pull out my secret treasure box and open it for the first time since I saw Grandpa at the hospital. This was our secret collection of little treasures, I tell Grammy. I show her the rusty spring and the doll's arm from Grandpa's last visit, plus some of Grandpa's favorites. I even show her the snake skin, which Grammy doesn't mind holding. So crinkly, she says. I sit in Grammy's lap. I miss his funny faces, I finally say. I do too, Grammy says. We sit and cry and think about Grandpa for a long time. I put the magnifying glass and watch in the treasure box, but not the little blue cap. We use it when we go for a walk to find interesting and amazing new things for our secret treasure box. And here's a story about two neighbors titled Nothing in Common. They had nothing in common, so they never waved. Except every day, they loved watching the old man with his dog. The dog could do marvelous things, and did. Things they felt under the floors of their hearts. But other than that, they had nothing in common. Still, they were the only ones who noticed when one day was different. Neither had ever seen an old man cry, or heard a name called so sadly it flies through your window and lands on your chest. It happened just to them. When morning came, they both went out with binoculars and a helmet for thinking. Because a marvelous dog could be anywhere, doing anything. And a marvelous friend is hard to find. They both knew that. They looked on the same quiet rooftops, and under the same whale, and near the same planets. And they thought of the same old man crying, but other than that, they had nothing in common. That day, when a hot air balloon floated over the city, they were the only ones who thought a dog might be flying it, a marvelous dog who was lost and looking for his friend far and wide. It could happen. Only they knew that. It was a big way for a dog to look for someone. And a big thing for just the two of them to notice. But dogs aren't birds. They can't see their way home from the sky, especially a dog without binoculars. And a balloon is a great moon with ropes. You need another person with a helmet. Someone who knows exactly where a balloon dog wants to go. Someone marvelous like that. It was a slow walk, one with time to notice things, things they had noticed before, tall things, how patient a dog in the sky is, how they both had the same feeling inside, a deep feeling that ballooned out. They pulled and pulled, and they knew the same way back, because they knew the same stars, and the same earth, and the same quiet rooftops they saw every night from their windows. And because they'd noticed the same old man every day, just the two of them. And they showed up with his dog, an old man who cried, this time because he was happy. Because the dog could do marvelous things, and did. Each thought the other was marvelous too, even though they'd had nothing in common. Nothing. And that's something. And they returned that dog and the balloon to the old man. Duck and Goose. Oh my, what is that? Duck quacked. That's a silly question, Goose honked. It is a big egg, of course. And they're looking at a soccer ball. Of course it is an egg. I know that, huffed Duck. What I mean is, where did it come from? Goose looked skyward. He looked to the river. He looked to the fields. He thought very hard. Who are you? He asked finally. I, said Duck, puffing out his feathered chest, am the one whose egg this is. I saw it first. Goose quickly raised one webbed foot. It's mine. I touched it first. Hey, you should never put your dirty foot on an egg, Duck scolded. Don't you know anything about caring for eggs? Yes, I do, Goose cried out. Stop yelling, Duck yelled, then whispered forcefully. Don't you know that you and your screaming are very likely disturbing the baby bird who is trying to take a snooze inside this egg? Goose wished that Duck wasn't right. He lowered his head and whispered softly, I'm very sorry. Go back to sleep in there. My, that's quite a beauty you have, called a bluebird from across the river. Thank you, it's mine, quacked Duck. Actually, it's mine, honked Goose, thank you. So, asked Duck, what do we do now? We should do something, suggested Goose. Yes, you are right. Good thinking, agreed Duck. Like what? Duck and Goose each thought. Well, we must keep the egg warm until the fuzzy little occupant is ready to come out, said Goose. Excellent idea, exclaimed Duck. He pushed past Goose. Step aside, and I shall do just that. But Goose was quick, too. After a flurry of fussing, grunting and groaning, slipping and sliding, honking and quacking, Duck and Goose found themselves back to back. Scoot over. I don't have any room, complained Duck. You are much closer to me than I am to you. Stop yelling in my ear, Goose. Shh, Goose hushed, pointing at the round thing beneath them. Yes, 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 we must remember. Quiet, quiet, quiet. We mustn't disturb the little one. And so they sat very still and very quiet, waiting. For a long time, they waited. They listened to the crickets chirp and the frogs burp. I am going to teach this baby bird to quack like a duck, Duck boasted. Well, I'm going to teach it to honk like a goose, Goose honked back. I'm going to teach this baby bird to waddle, Goose added. So am I, Duck said. They heard the pitter-patter of the rain. I'm going to teach this baby bird to swim, Duck said. Me too, Goose said. To pass the time, they sniffed wildflowers in the warm sun and shared breadcrumbs while Goose taught Duck to honk. They watched the sun set in the sky and Duck taught Goose to quack. They counted the stars in the night sky. Let's teach our baby to fly, said Goose. Good idea, said Duck. I'm sure our baby will be a fast learner. If it takes after you and me, I'm sure you're right, agreed Goose. Together, they waited until... Did you feel that, Duck? Duck nodded, yes. Did you feel that, Goose? Goose nodded. It's time, Goose, it's time, Duck squawked. Quickly, Duck slid down and started running in circles around their egg. Oh, what should we do now, he hollered. I think we should remain calm, Goose yelled back. Excuse me, a little voice called out. Duck stopped. In all the exciting confusion, he had failed to notice the bluebird kicking their egg. Can I play too? She asked. Play? This is no time for play, yelled Duck. This is no time for games, yelled Goose. And what's with the kicking? I was only trying to get your attention, said the little bird. Well, you got it, Duck huffed. False alarm, Goose. Back to work. Can't you see that we are very busy here? Goose explained to the bluebird. This is serious business. This is perhaps the most important moment of our lives. Oh my, I am sorry, apologized the bluebird. I had no idea. I just thought that maybe I could play with your ball. It really is a nice one, she added, and then she flew away. Goose gulped. Did she say ball? He whispered to Duck. You know, I did have my doubts, Duck finally said. It is a bit squishier than most eggs I've seen. Yes, and I must say, I was somewhat suspicious of those big dots, Goose admitted. It may not be an egg, but it is lovely, said Duck. Oh, absolutely, Duck, Goose agreed. It's a keeper. As the crickets chirped, the frogs burped, and the grass swayed in a gentle breeze, Goose quacked and Duck honked, and the ball bounced, rolled, and sometimes even flew. Okay, I'm going to finish up the first half hour of today's program with a picture book titled Ivanhoe Swift Left Home at 6. Ivanhoe Swift left home when he was 6. He had heard many songs about the world, and it was time to see it for himself. Ivanhoe took down his map from the wall. We won't know where you are, cried his father. I'll know where you are, said Ivanhoe, and you can look out for my kite in the sky. Goodbye, parents. His mother sang him a song as he left. Go well as you travel, my little love, over the world as you roam. But if you grow weary and tire of your journey, then let the sea bring you home. Let the sea bring you home. First, Ivanhoe went to the tall tree. The world went on forever. I'll just start walking, he said to himself, and see what I can see. After a while, Ivanhoe met someone. What's your name? I'm Maisie Jane, said Maisie Jane. What are you carrying? She asked. A hat and a pencil, the map from my wall, my kite, and the songs in my head, said Ivanhoe. Oh, and I did have a sandwich, but I ate that. I'm Ivanhoe Swift, and I'm going to see the world. Great, said Maisie Jane. I'll come too. Ivanhoe and Maisie Jane walked until they reached a river. It looked flat and still, but underneath it was moving fast. Maisie and Ivanhoe ran through the field to where the apple trees grew. Maisie Jane collected pine cones and Ivanhoe collected mushrooms. Then Ivanhoe sang her a song as they cooked up a feast. The next day they came to a little house with a red roof at the edge of the woods. I like this house, said Maisie Jane. Will you stay here with me? But Ivanhoe hadn't seen much of the world yet, so he said goodbye to Maisie Jane. Ivanhoe walked through the woods. They were cool and soft and dark in the middle. When the shadows grew long, Ivanhoe sang every song he knew to keep himself company. After some time, he came to a town. There was a lot to explore in the world, and not everyone was like Maisie Jane. Ivanhoe journeyed on. One evening, he reached the sea. It shimmered and shone and went right to the edge of forever. Ivanhoe sang a song of wonder, and the sea joined in. Shh, shh, the waves whispered to him. Ivanhoe sat on a rock to fix his kite, but the shh became louder. The waves were too big. Now Ivano was wet and cold, and his kite had been swept away. There was nothing left in his bag. His map was soggy. Ivano felt a little lonely. After all, he was only 6. He wondered about Maisie Jane. He worried about his parents now that they couldn't see his kite. Ivano was very tired. He whispered his mother's song. As he sang, the sea became calmer. He lay down. Go well as you travel, my little love, over the world as you roam. But if you grow weary and tire of your journey, then let the sea bring you home. Let the sea bring you home. Ivano, there you are. I found your kite. It was Maisie Jane. Thank you, said Ivano. He sat up. Let's see if it flies again. They walked on all afternoon, the kite flying above them, until... I know where we are, said Ivano. Would you like to come to my house for dinner? Ivano's parents put their arms around him. Oh, Ivano, they said. After dinner, Maisie went back to her little house. Please come again, said Ivano. Ivano sang his parents all his new songs. Tell us, they said, did you see the world? Ivano thought for a moment. I did, he told them. Enough of it. For now, and there he is. He has his flashlight out, and he's looking at his little map in the dark. And this is just a reminder. My name is Andy Bombeck, and I hope you're enjoying the Children's Story Hour. And as I mentioned at the beginning of today's program, I'm going to continue reading a book that I started just last week that won the Newbery Award, which is given to the best children's book, in 1958, titled The Family Under the Bridge. Armand, an old man living on the streets of Paris, is happy with his carefree existence, begging and doing odd jobs to keep himself warm and fed. With a life of simple pleasures, what more could he need? Then one day, just before Christmas, Armand returns to his favorite spot beneath the bridge to find 3 cold and hungry children. Although he has no interest in children, Armand soon finds himself caring for the small family. It does not take Armand very long to realize that he must do whatever it takes to find them a real home. Okay, last week, Armand overhears children talking about a tramp, which is himself. So he threatens the children that Father Christmas will not come to them for being so rude. Then he runs into 3 children under the bridge where he lives. The 3 children explain that their papa died and they were kicked out of their home. 3 red-haired kids, Susie, Paul, and Evelyn. The 3 kids' mom shows up and is not happy they are sharing the bridge with Armand. The 3 kids and mom will do anything to stay together as a family and not be separated. He asks the 3 children if they would like to go with him and meet Father Christmas. And that's where I left off last week. What's your name, Monsieur? Asked Susie. Armand, replied the hobo. But your last name, asked Paul. Ours is Kalit. Armand shrugged his shoulders. I've forgotten, he admitted. I think it used to be Puli or Punji. Something like that. Just call me Armand. All right, Monsieur Armand, said Paul. I apologize for calling you an old tramp. Now, will you take us with you? Of course he will, said Susie quickly. He really has a good heart, even if he looks so bad. And may Jojo go too? Armand clutched at the part of his coat covering his heart. Oh, these starlings were after it, all right. Ooh la la, he exclaimed. And where would I be seen with 3 children and a dog, he demanded. What friend would want me dropping in with such a company? Then a sly look crossed his weather-beaten face. Perhaps it wouldn't be a bad idea to take these appealing fledglings out on the street with him. No, indeed. He had a splendid idea. Of course, it wasn't just the thing of which that proud mother would approve. "How would you like to go uptown and meet my friend Father Christmas?" he asked the children. They were so astonished that they couldn't speak for a few seconds. Susie's eyes grew bluer and bluer with wonder. "Father Christmas!" she finally exclaimed in a hushed voice. "The Father Christmas who brings presents at Christmas time?" Paul could hardly believe it. "Do you know Father Christmas?" he asked. "Mama said he won't bring us anything this year because he won't be able to find us," said Evelyn. "Then we're going right up to the Louvre department store," declared Armand, "and tell him where you are living." Chapter 3. Armand, the Paris hobo, led the red-headed children up the steps to the busy city above. His old mind under his old beret was busy with great plans for the children and himself. Perhaps startlings weren't too bad. They had their uses. He walked ahead, leading the way across the bridge and around Notre Dame. Susie followed with Evelyn clinging to her hand. Sometimes Paul lagged to look at something. Sometimes he ran ahead to talk with the hobo. The dog that should have been white trotted along at Susie's worn-down heels. They straggled across the bridge that tied the island to the right bank. The children turned to stare at all the fancy towers and turrets on the roof of the Hotel de Ville. "That's the city hall where they run Paris," explained Armand. "Humph. I could run it better from under the bridge." Blue pigeons fluttered around them, hopefully. "Beggars," snorted the tramp, "always pestering folks for a handout." Jojo felt the same way. He chased away any that alighted too close to the children. "I wish we had some corn to feed them," said Paul. "See what I mean?" asked Armand. "Even people who haven't any food themselves are ready to feed the pigeons. Wish I was one." They walked through a dreary, cobbled street until they reached the busy Rue de Rivoli. It was crowded with holiday shoppers. Christmas was really getting close to the business street. Vendors behind sidewalk stands were bawling out their wares and imploring passers-by to examine their merchandise. Shoppers were buying earrings and suspenders and water softeners and silk scarves from the vendors. They were buying frantically and noisily, as if they might never again find anything for sale on the Rue de Rivoli. And the way they were madly buying, perhaps there wouldn't be anything left on the street next day. Armand was continually having to turn around and coax the children along. They wanted to stop and look at everything. They stopped to stare at a mechanical soldier that a man was demonstrating on the sidewalk. The soldier marched and saluted smartly. It took some time to get Paul away from the soldier. "Cheap toy," scoffed Armand. "Take it home and it won't work, or the spring will break the first time it's wound. A friend of mine used to sell those things." No sooner had he coaxed them away from the mechanical toy than they came to a bakery shop. There was a Christmas log cake in the window. Such a delicious log. It was chocolatey brown with fancy mushrooms popping from its sweet bark. Pink spun sugar roses grew out of the chocolate too. And such a real-looking ivy vine twined around it, spreading luscious green leaves. "Ah, oh, doesn't it look good?" exclaimed Susie, licking her lips. "I could eat it all by myself," cried Paul. "I'm hungry," whined Evelyn. Armand pulled at each one in turn. "It really tastes like medicine," he said. all but the vine. That tastes exactly like ivy, tough and bitter. I ate a Christmas log once. The children did not look as if they believed him. Oh, it's a tricky way they have of getting children to take medicine, he insisted. They crossed the street when the policeman stopped the line of automobiles. They came to a big iron brazier where a man was selling hot chestnuts as fast as he could roast them. The air was warm around the brazier, and the smell of chestnuts was tantalizing. The children stopped and looked hungrily into the brazier. "Come, come," said Armand impatiently. "Chestnuts are wormy. Do you think Father Christmas is going to wait until midnight for us? We've still got a long way to the Louvre." But there was so much to see that the way seemed quite short. Soon, they were walking through the street arcades of the store building. And it seemed that as much was being sold outside as in, with all the push carts and street hawkers. Armand shepherded his little flock through one of the great glass doors of which the store was so proud. When the children and the dog were once inside, they felt transported into fairyland. It was warm and beautiful in the great store with its bright lights and moving colors. There was an odor of mixed perfumes, as if all the flowers in the world were blooming behind the counters that were covered with soft clothing and glittering jewels. "We have to go up to the mezzanine," said Armand. "Might as well use their elevator and save our feet for the walk back." So they went to the nearest elevator, but all the people waiting could not possibly crowd into it at the same time. "We'll have to take the steps," decided Armand. "Wouldn't you think some of those women would stay home and do their washing and cooking?" "Our mother would if she could," said Susie quickly. They climbed the stairs. The children's eyes grew dreamier and dreamier. They saw tables piled high with toys. They were entertaining the domain of Father Christmas. On tiptoe, reverently, they followed the old hobo to the studio, where a child could have his picture taken with the saint, providing his parents paid for it. Armand peeped in. The children stopped breathing. "He's not here," said the hobo in a disappointed voice. But even as he spoke, Father Christmas himself came around the counters. He was dressed in a long red robe that reached his ankles, and a curly white beard covered his chest. His mustache was waved and waxed, but his black eyes were snapping as he shook his fist at two boys running ahead of him. "And if I catch you playing with the electric trains again, I'll put you out of the store," he threatened them. The Calquette children were frightened. They shrank behind Armand. And as Father Christmas approached them, Evelyn burst into frightened tears and Jojo growled. At sight of Armand, the angry lines left the forehead of Father Christmas and blithery curled around his lips. His eyes softened with pleasure and amusement. "Ho, ho, ho," he laughed, in a way that Father Christmas should laugh. "Look at those dear old grandpapa has come to see me today." And he went on with his ho, 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 until the children were afraid he had a coughing spell. Armand pulled the little Colettes in front of him one by one. Evelyn stopped crying and Jojo stopped growling. "You'd never believe where I found them," said Armand. "But they wanted to come to see you." The children's eyes were shining again. They were speechless with delight. "Well, have you been good children this year?" asked Father Christmas.
"We've tried to be," parried Susie.
"Sometimes we get mixed up about what's good and what isn't," confessed Paul. "I pulled Jojo's tail, but I won't do it any more," confessed Evelyn. Father Christmas was pleased. "Oh, I like truthful children," he said.
All the rest of them declare they've been angels all year. Now, what do you want me to bring you for Christmas?
We want a house, said Susie. Will you please bring us a house, Father Christmas?
Ho, 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 replied Father Christmas. That should be agreeable to your parents. And what kind of house do you want? A dollhouse?
He glanced down at Jojo.
Or a doghouse?
A real house, said Paul. A house we can live in.
With walls and a roof, said Susie. And windows, added Evelyn.
I like to watch out of the window when it's time for Susie and Paul to come home from school.
Father Christmas stopped his jolly ho, 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 and stared at them.
Who ever heard of children wanting a real house for Christmas? He asked. What about a drum for the lad and dolls for the girls?
No, insisted Susie. It has to be a real house.
Father Christmas rolled his black eyes around and twirled the ends of his mustache.
It will have to be dolls or games, he said. My little donkey can't carry a house on his back, you know that.
The children's faces fell. Then Susie remembered her manners.
Thank you anyway, Father Christmas, she said in a quivering voice. I guess we don't want anything but a house.
I do, said Paul. I want something to eat.
And I want a doll, added Evelyn.
Father Christmas started to speak, but a pretty salesgirl interrupted him.
You better get into the studio, or Monsieur Latour will fire you, she said.
There are four children waiting to have their pictures taken. Father Christmas patted each red head in farewell. Then he said to Armand, our Monsieur Latour is looking for a night watchman's, for a friend's building. Want the job?
Ooh la la, exclaimed Armand. I didn't come here to ask Father Christmas for a job. Goodbye, Camille.
He led the children down the steps again, but now they were strangely silent. Even Jojo's ears drooped and his tail dragged. The main floor was less crowded as they walked between the counters. An elegant floor walker caught sight of the vagabonds. He hurried to them. He made a little noise as he tapped the immaculatory white handkerchief peeping from his breast pocket.
Aren't you in the wrong store? He asked hauntingly.
I should say we're in the wrong store, replied Armand, just as hauntingly. We brought our dog in here to ride the escalators, and all I see is those crowded elevators. He whistled to Jojo, come, boy, we'll take you over to the print imps. Jojo growled at the haunting floor walker. The little group headed for the great glass door of which the store was so proud. They shivered as they stepped out in the cold, bittering air.
Chapter 4. There's a fancy Christmas window out here you should see, said Armand to the children. He wanted to cheer them because they were so silent and forlorn. He led them to the main doors facing the Palais Royal Square. A crowd of people blocked the window, but the tramp and his companions wormed their way to the front. The children's eyes bulged, such a grand sight they had never seen. A scroll near the front of the window said that the scene was the marriage of Tartine. It was truly a wedding out of a storybook. Two mechanical figures, a man and a woman, dressed in gorgeous white costumes of long ago, stood in a high pavilion. They bowed sedately to each other while music tinkled romantically. But even more remarkable was the parade of tiny figurines below the lovers. They were white-capped cooks bearing wondrous dishes to the wedding feast. One carried a gaudy peacock, which raised and lowered its neck in time to the tune. Another held up a great crab that clicked out the rhythm with its claws.
And yet another carried a cake even fancier than the Christmas log in the bakery window. Each little cook was so proud of his dish that he waltzed around and around as he paraded. "I bet they will live in a beautiful castle after their wedding," sighed Susie, gazing at the lovely bride and groom. "I'm hungry," said Paul. "Me too," agreed Evelyn. The dog, that should have been white, was drooling on a man's shoes. A crafty look came into Armand's eyes. "I bet you know the words of that tune they're playing," he coaxed. "It's Dame Tartine. If you'll sing it for me, I'll get you something to eat." Paul put his hand over his mouth. Evelyn put her finger in hers. Susie shyly shook her head. "There are too many people here," she said. "Then sing for them," said Armand. "Don't be stupid starlings without a song in your throats. Open your little beaks and sing like canaries." So Paul pulled his hand from his mouth and began to sing in a thin but firm voice. Then Susie joined him in a sweet, high tone. Evelyn took her finger out of her mouth and chirped with them. They sang like three little birds on a branch in the springtime. When they had finished two verses, Armand clapped hard. Then he pulled his beret off his head and held it out to one person after another in the crowd. "Almonds," he begged. "Ames for a poor, old grandfather with three fatherless children to clothe and feed, and an orphan dog." The people gave generously because they felt the spirit of Christmas. The coins clinked into the hobo's beret. The concert had been so successful that Armand waited until the first audience left and a new one came to look at the window. Then he had the children sing again. And again he passed his beret for coins. This might have gone on for some time if the hauntingly floor walker hadn't come out of the store to see why the crowd around the window was bigger than ever. He scowled at the quartet. "On your way," he ordered them, with a wave of his hand and his nose in the air. "No begging in front of the Louvre." Armand did not mind leaving. His beret was heavy with francs, which he funneled into his pocket. "Come, canaries," he said. "You are good children. I'll treat you to pancakes." He took them around the corner to where a Breton man stood behind a stand making thin pancakes on two round black irons. "I'll take a dozen for a starter," ordered Armand. But he had to show his money before the Breton would pour the batter on an iron. One by one, the man made the pancakes, so slowly that the children thought they would die of hunger before he had made a full dozen. The smell was even better than that of the perfume in the Louvre. The cakes were big as scooter wheels and thin as silk. The Breton spread each one with butter and jelly, then folded it twice. Everyone got three pancakes. Then Jojo whined pitifully, and they remembered that he was probably hungry too. So Armand ordered another dozen pancakes. They started back, munching happily on their pancakes, but Jojo kept on whining because he had swallowed each of his in one big gulp. When they reached a corner where a crowd of shoppers was waiting for buses, Armand suggested to the children that they entertain the weary people with some Christmas carols. The little cockettes were less shy this time. They sang as loud as they could. As before, the hobo passed his bread around. "Almonds," he begged, "so a poor old man can feed his starving children." But as the coins fell into his cap, an angry fist rapped against his back. Armand was frightened because he thought it was a policeman. But it was only another man as ragged as himself. A big box hung from his neck, and in it a little monkey dressed in a red and green suit made faces through a screen.
"What do you mean, cutting into my territory?" demanded the man with the monkey. "You're stealing my show."
Armand tried to make peace. "Now, don't let's cross words, T.D.," he said. "There's enough of a crowd for both of us. The kind of people who like to listen to choirs wouldn't be interested in watching a monkey make faces anyway."
T.D. was not soothed.
"Children or monkeys, what's the difference?" he demanded. "And this is my corner." But the children did not join in the quarrel, although Jojo barked at the monkey, and the monkey made his worst face at the dog. Then the monkey gave the children a sad smile and held out its green cap to them.
"Oh, he wants money too," said Susie. "And there's a bull on top of the box for coins. Please give the little monkey some money, Monsieur Armand."
"Indeed I will not," snapped Armand.
"Please, please, Monsieur," begged Evelyn. "The little monkey wants to buy some pancakes too."
By this time, most of the shoppers had boarded their buses. Armand tried to hustle his choir away, but the children wouldn't let him leave until he had dropped a coin in the bowl for the monkey.
"That T.D. is a fake," explained the hobo as they walked down the street. "He's just using the monkey to make money for himself."
And he rattled the coins in his own pocket. When they came to the chestnut vendor, he treated them again. They waited as long as they could before eating the chestnuts because the hot smells warmed their hands.
"Now remember," Armand cautioned the children, "not a word about this to your mama, and I'll take you with me every day."
But when Madame Colette came wearily down the steps that evening, the children rushed to meet her.
"I saved a pancake for you, Mama," cried Susie, digging into the pocket of her faded coat. "It's cold now, but it still tastes sweet."
Paul reached into his coat pocket, too.
"And I brought you some chestnuts, Mama," he said. "They're cold, too, but they'll taste good."
Evelyn began to sob. "I didn't have anything for you, Mama," she wept. "I forgot."
Madame Colette hugged her. "Never mind," she said. "I brought something for you."
Then her voice grew suspicious.
"Where did you get the pancakes and the chestnuts?" she asked.
And unfortunately, this is all the time that we have for today. I hope everyone enjoyed today's program as much as I did. I want to say hi to all the listeners out there, and I want to encourage everyone to tune in next week when I continue with the interesting novel titled The Family Under the Bridge. Until then, I hope everyone has a great day and a fantastic week. So long and take care, everyone. Goodbye.